You're listening to The World Is Just a Book Away podcast. I'm James Owens, founder and CEO of The World Is Just a Book Away, a nonprofit organization on a mission to promote literacy and education by developing libraries and programs in disadvantaged communities around the world. For more information about The World Is Just a Book Away, please visit www.wijaba.org. That's WIJABA.org. My guest today on The World Is Just a Book Away podcast is Leo Carew. Leo, author of The Wolf, grew up in the shadow of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Initially inspired by audiobooks, Leo developed a late interest in reading, which was quickly followed by an interest in writing. After graduating from high school, Leo spent 2 months on expeditions in the high Arctic archipelago of Svalbard, which is Old Norse for the cold edge. After graduating from Cambridge University, Leo returned to Svalbard to train and work as an Arctic guide for 12 months, at times in 24-hour darkness while living in a tent. It was during this year that Leo revisited the novel he began to write as a teenager. That novel emerged as The Wolf. Leo currently lives in London, writing, studying medicine to pursue a career as an army medic, and escaping for an adventure to the cold and wild regions whenever he can. Leo and I discuss his being diagnosed with dyspraxia, being unable to read at the age of 10, memorizing the audio version of Harry Potter, and teaching himself to read by matching the words in the book to his memory. Our conversation ranges from pre-agrarian humans and Neanderthals to his journey in Arctic regions, climbing and naming two previously unsummited mountains in Greenland, and living on a barge on the Thames in London, where he isolates himself from technology and reads by candlelight. Today, I'm very excited to have with us for our listeners, Leo Carew, author of The Wolf, and soon to be followed by The Spider, I understand, correct, Leo?
That's right, yeah.
Which will be coming out in June.
Yeah, sure will.
And this is part of a trilogy, is that correct?
Yes, indeed. Third book's going to be The Cuckoo. It's going to be interesting to see how long I've got to write that because sort of medical school commitments and things coming up, and The Spider has been a big effort trying to get that done at the same time as medicine.
Could you say the name of the third book again?
The Cuckoo is the plan at the moment. I'm not sure if in the States it might be slightly different, but that's the plan in the UK. I know my American editor is looking at something else.
I just wanted to make you say it again because it sounds better with a British accent. Sounds
cuckoo.
It sounds particularly cuckoo with the British, accent. Leo, I usually begin by telling my listeners how I connected with someone. We had a very interesting way of meeting because we were both at the Festival of Literature in the UAE. And I finally got to take a break and sit in that very long segmented hot tub, almost like five or six of them joined together. And then we started chatting, and I was just really fascinated by our initial conversation that went on, and we ended up having dinner. And so what I learned about you in that conversation is that you grew up in the UK, you ended up intrigued by a place I'd never heard called Svalbard, is that correct?
Svalbard, yeah.
Svalbard, which is part of Norway, but off in the Arctic?
Yes, exactly. So it's like a group of islands owned by Norway. It's like one of the last bits of the Treaty of Versailles, which is still in action. It's called the Svalbard Treaty. And as part of the Treaty of Versailles, the sort of victorious post-First World War powers granted sovereignty of Svalbard to Norway to sort of preserve and look after. So it's about halfway between the top of mainland Norway and the North Pole, this big group of islands where sort of, you know, polar bears outnumber people and It's like 24-hour darkness for 4 months of the year, and it's pretty special. It's amazing.
And you spend some time there, and then you studied, or as you say in England, I think, read biological anthropology at Cambridge, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Then you liked the cold and the isolation so much that you went back to to live in a tent for a year and train as an Arctic guide.
Yes.
And then in the process of doing all of this, you're also part of the Army Reserve and studying to be a doctor?
So I'm studying to be a doctor, and I'm sponsored by the Army. So when I'm finished, I become an Army doctor and go straight into the military, and they employ me for the next sort of, I owe them, I think, 5 years of service in return for their sponsorship through med school.
Okay. And in addition to that, you're writing a trilogy and you live on a barge on the Thames.
That is about the sum of it. Yes.
Okay, so this is just our average life that we have here. and you're in your late 20s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So 27.
Clearly an underachiever in life, and you don't do anything interesting. Oh, I forgot to mention the thing that really intrigued me the most, that you've done expeditions into Greenland and summited mountains that have not been climbed before, and you got the opportunity to name one.
Yes, indeed. Or two we named, actually, but one of sort of more note than the other. Yeah, I mean, one of them was kind of a hill, which we gave ourselves a little consolation prize after we failed spectacularly to climb one of the mountains. We tried twice, and it is one of the most sort of lung-busting, heartbreaking moments of my entire life. Like, I'd never understood summit fever properly before that. We'd invested everything, you know, this expedition of sort of 2 months. You work so hard to put yourself in a position to climb something that's never been done before. And obviously there's the build up to that expedition, which has been like years in the making, sort of sponsorship and planning and all that. And then we got to within 30 meters of the summit and had to turn back. And I've never known I've never known heartbreak like that before, since, I guess. Like, that was sort of, that is the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life, turn around from that, even though, you know, it's sort of going on would have been almost suicide. And on the way back down, we just sort of on this plateau, and we crossed over the largest mound for miles. So that was sort of technically an unclimbed peak. And we will name it. We call it something unglorious like Sugar Heap. But that one wasn't so significant. So we did successfully climb another much better one and got to name that more seriously.
And you named it?
That one is Bjørneskuldefjellet, which is summit of the bear's shoulder, like a polar bear shoulder.
Wow. Well, that's I can honestly say, of all the people I've interviewed and met in my life, I've never met anyone who named a mountain. So that was a very interesting. That was just a super interesting encounter with you and conversation and dinner. And then I got introduced to the wolf through that. We were talking about our books. And I just want to read what just this very brief thing that Kirkus Review says in your book. An action-packed and blood-spattered tour de force. Karoo is the real deal, an exciting new voice in fantasy. Kirkus Reviews. So can you tell us a little bit about the wolf, what inspired you, and what the general storyline is?
The wolf has been a really, really long time in the making. I wrote the first incarnation of it when I was 12. Obviously like a horrible, terrible version of it, which I can't reread at all now without sort of just, you know, cringing horrendously. But it's been brewing and sort of developing ever since then. I had this kind of, mostly it started because I was bored, and I always came up with sort of scenarios and stories in my head to fill my time. And one day got to wondering, why is it that human beings seem to be about the sort of weakest animal around? You know, everything else of comparable weight is sort of stronger than us, faster than us, toothier than us. And why is it that we seem so physically feeble? And it got me wondering about this kind of species of people who were the wild physical equals of wild animals. And as sort of time went on, I went to off to Cambridge and studied biological anthropology. I learned that the reason we're so sort of physically feeble is because when we adopted agriculture, we domesticated ourselves, like we did cattle and, you know, sort of sheep and things. And almost overnight, in the kind of blink of an eye, anthropologically speaking, our height dropped by a foot. Our brains got much, much smaller. Our jaws shrank. Our bones became much sort of much less robust, much less dense. And our faces got much more kind of much less rugged, like much more charming and expressive and sort of much more childlike, really. And it's just, it was this whole suite of adaptations to allow us to live at close quarters with one another. So we were sort of less mobile, less aggressive, and also a bit partly sort of, you know, when you start living close to each other, you breed viruses, and those, that's what caused us to drop in height so much more, because we were much more sickly after we adopted agriculture. And that really intrigued me, that there'd been a period when human beings were sort of this kind of, there's like a wild equivalent of human beings, like a wolf is to a dog. So we're the dog, and like our ancestors were kind of much more wolf-like, much more wild. And it just really fascinated me how they might have been in terms of behavior. And how, not just...
Sorry. How many years ago was this? When did that switch to agriculture happen?
It was at different periods throughout the... agriculture sort of developed in different places at different times. You know, sort of fairly early on, like earliest incarnations in the kind of Middle East and things, maybe 9,000 years ago. And then it spreads across, it spreads fairly rapidly because agricultural societies are much more centralized and have much, because they're so much more intense, they can have people in much smaller areas than hunter-gatherer societies. If you don't adopt agriculture, you will be wiped out by the ones who do. So it becomes sort of inevitable that from its first development, it spreads all across humanity, basically.
And you were the first person who ever said to me that humans dropped in height. So what was it in that period that we dropped a foot in height?
Yes, it was immediately after adopting agriculture. We used to be sort of much taller, more robust, about 6'2". We've probably been a sort of fairly average height for a, you know, for a male pre-agriculture. And as soon as you adopt it, everyone lives at very close quarters. And that means that viruses can mutate and sort of bacteria can and pass along much faster. And you spend a lot more of your life sickly and ill. And that means that your growth is stunted because you're sort of not diverting energy into growth as you're growing up. You're diverting it into fighting off viruses and infections and things instead. So that's why you sort of end up much, much shorter very, very suddenly.
And so this whole concept intrigued you and was leading you into the process of reworking the book from the, is this the same book that you started when you were 12?
Exactly. Yeah. it really fascinated me. And then it wasn't, that was sort of part of it. That was part of what went into the alternate species of human that I ended up coming out with, who are called the Anakin. And another part was the, I loved learning about the other species of human as well, the fact that there was a really long period of human history. Like this period of human history is really unusual in that we are the only species of human on the planet today. But for the vast majority of history, or prehistory, there have been many, many species, and Neanderthals and sort of Denisovans and Homo erectus and things like that. And lots of other, probably quite a few others that we have never discovered in the fossil record, but we know existed because of genetic evidence they've left behind. And I was really intrigued how it would have been to sort of, you know, imagine you're one of the first sort of Homo sapiens settlers in Europe and you enter a forest and you meet a Neanderthal for the first time. And how it would have felt to meet something that was like you, but so sort of profoundly alien. an entirely different species. And it just really, really fascinating how, to me, how they might have thought and kind of had they survived to a modern era, what sort of society they might have set up. So the wolf is partly kind of envisaging, like, had multiple species of human survived the Ice Age and gone on to set up their own societies, what might those have looked like? How might they have interacted with modern human societies? And I just really loved that sort of question.
And then this continues through, because this is sort of a fight between the North and the South. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
And
yeah, I just wanted like a nice sort of setting to have the wild Anakin living in. And the North has always called to me a bit more. It's always a bit more sort of rugged and, you know, a bit less tamed and kind of cultivated. And I thought that seemed like a more likely home for them. So in the book, they've been pushed into this refuge at the north of Albion, the island they live on. And there's this big battle which unfolds between them and the people who live in the south, who are kind of basically the modern humans.
And then this will unfold, if you're not revealing too much, if you're allowed to, this will continue unfolding over the course of the three novels?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Continue unfolding and hopefully resolve.
Hopefully, right?
Hopefully, yeah.
As you complete medical school.
Yes, I hope so. I think it's going to be intense. Next year is my final year, so I'm trying to do that and the third book in the trilogy at the same time. Maybe a challenge, but I like to keep busy.
But clearly. Yes. Any plans to climb any new mountains in Greenland and in your, I don't know, the equivalent of your spring break or summer break?
I'd love to. Not like, I haven't got a current expedition lined up. I'm slightly thinking that because the army likes to keep you busy, I might be able to get them on board with some, you know, sponsoring some of the expeditions and maybe lead a sort of army team up a couple of them. That might be really fun. I feel like that's the kind of place to, you know, exploit those opportunities.
And then you also shared with me, and it's a place I've wanted to go that I do know about, that you spent about 6 weeks alone in the Outer Hebrides?
Yes. Yeah.
And just for the listeners who haven't heard of the Hebrides, can you explain where they are and how you ended up there?
The Hebrides are a collection of islands off the northwest coast of Scotland. So quite far north in the UK. And I feel slightly in two minds about revealing this, but they are glorious. They're they're quite sparsely populated, but they're these just absolute gems, like gorgeous white sand beaches and amazing kind of hills and like lovely sort of sea lashed coastline and things. Just wonderful place. And I ended up going to an island quite near the edge of them and stayed there for 6 weeks in a cabin on my own, apart from had my dog for company. And it was just honestly one of the best things I've ever done. Obviously no internet, no electricity. So all lighting was provided by sort of oil lamps in the evening and lots of reading for entertainment and long windy walks and no supplies either, because the weather is so rough out there. It's really hard to get boats over from the mainland. So was mostly kind of hunting and gathering food. So eating limpets and mussels, and went out deer hunting, and seaweed was the main green. And it was just wonderful. It was really, it was completely unexpected how much of a impact that had on my mood. So I've never been on my own before for any significant period of time. And that was the first time I'd ever been on my own for more than about 48 hours, I'd say. And by week two, I got into this weird sort of state of euphoria where everything I looked at was just sort of symmetrical and beautiful and just unbelievably glorious. And I was looking at things like a sort of old pine table, you know, not massively prepossessing, or like all the sort of cabin's wooden interior, or just like just everything was suddenly like symmetrical and like miraculous. And there was this real sense of kind of energy to everything. And I've never experienced anything like that in my entire life. And that went on for the remainder of the time I was there. And it was just, it was sort of this really bizarre euphoria. It was kind of, I'd never known anything like it.
And this is that where you completed The Wolf?
No, that was, The Wolf was done by then. That's where I wrote most of The Spider.
Okay.
So although it was only 6 weeks, it was very, very productive. And yeah, sort of, I think about 2/3 of it was produced during those 6 weeks.
Oh. Well, let's as you know, the purpose of this podcast is really to share thoughts from interesting people and authors, writers about reading in books. And what role has reading played in your life? What importance or what role has it played in your life?
Reading's been completely massive for me. When I was younger, I was diagnosed with a condition called dyspraxia, actually, which no longer exists. Like, it's no longer accepted as a sort of relevant diagnosis by various medical bodies in the UK and across Europe and things. So it's kind of equivalent to a sort of dyslexia / ADHD, something along those lines. But the result was basically that I just had no interest in reading at all for a very long time, and was very, very slow to learn. So by the age of 10, I still couldn't read properly. And obviously that made me like a bit of an academic no-hoper. I wasn't particularly worried, and I don't think my parents were that worried either, but my school was obviously despairing. And it was audiobooks, which finally changed that for me. And actually it was Harry Potter. I wish it had been something less, you know, mainstream, but Harry Potter completely changed my life because I listened to it on cassette tape. And I have quite a good memory for hearing, and ended up listening to it so much that I had the entire thing off by heart. And then opened up a book and matched each noise I remembered being made in the cassette tape with the word in the book. And that's how I learned to read. And that's what sort of persuaded me to pick up a book for the first time, and set me completely on the path I'm on today. Like, I really can't imagine where I'd be if I hadn't sort of chanced to listen to Harry Potter once while I was on a sick day off school. And that's informed everything in my life so far. And it's kind of, obviously reading's become huge for me since, like, I'm a writer now. And then, like lots of the books I've read have sort of are what have persuaded me to do pretty much everything I've done since then, I think.
And so if I'm understanding correctly, your brain was able to retain the exact, the exact dialogue, the exact prose of Harry Potter, and then you could go to the page and figure out the word because your brain had retained it from the audiobook?
Yes, exactly.
And so do you have some sort of audio photographic memory?
Yeah, it seems to be sort of the equivalent of that, basically.
That's amazing.
It's sort of amazing, but then also I tend to, the result tends to be that I fall asleep very fast when I'm listening to people. When people give me sort of too much like information, I sort of remember it very well at first and then very quickly fall asleep.
While they're speaking to you or after?
I start glazing over while they're sort of speaking to me. The trouble, like, if people are speaking to me directly, I can usually hold it together, but it's really embarrassing during sort of lectures and things at medical school. I'm just constantly having to stand up because otherwise I just fall asleep straight away. And it always looks really rude to the lecturer if they quite often think you've got a point to make and sort of ask you to explain why you've stood up. And it's like, I'm really sorry, I'm just on the verge of falling asleep. So it's sort of, it's good to begin with, and then like it has its downsides.
Well, it sounds like you've really learned how to maximize it as an opportunity for yourself.
I'd like to think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell? So Harry Potter, it sounds like Harry Potter is the book that really shifted you into the world of books, into reading. Is there another book that you can think of that has that has inspired you in life?
Yes, there's one which sticks out like far and away above the others. And I think I spoke to you about this in Dubai, actually. It was The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman, which was released under the name Northern Lights in the UK. And for those who've not read it, it's like a sort of, it's like a kind of fantasy set in this sort of dirty industrial era world where there's sort of zeppelins and paraffin, and kind of the main difference is that people have this animal manifestation of their soul, which walks alongside them and can talk and sort of, you know, reveals quite a lot about you. And that book totally changed my life in the most bizarre ways, which I'm only just starting to appreciate now. So lots of it is set in Svalbard. And I only realized when I got to Svalbard and was living in this tent, and 24-hour darkness for 4 months in a tent gives you a lot of time to think. And I was finally thinking, why am I here? And I realized it was completely because of the description that Philip Pullman painted in that book, The Golden Compass, of the Arctic. It was just so magical and so sort of different and alien. I just knew I had to be there, and I knew that I'd had this feeling throughout my entire childhood and adolescence that I had to go live in the Arctic. And I only realized when I got there that had originally come from listening to the audiobook again of that book, Northern Lights, when I was about sort of 10 years old. And the more I look back, the more I realize what sort of, how much of an impact that's had on my life. Like, again, like I've become a explorer, and those explorers feature like pretty heavily in the book. My favorite wine is Tokaj, which is it's like this Hungarian sweet wine, which one of the main characters in the book is like a massive fan of. And obviously live on a canal boat, which again, feature really heavily in the story. And none of those choices have been conscious at all, but it's quite an extreme example of like how big an impact reading can have on you. And I'm sure The Golden Compass was responsible for all that, because it captured me so profoundly when I was younger. And it seems to have kind of orientated my life ever since then in a really bizarre ways, which kind of keep coming out.
So you listen to this book, you listen to The Golden Compass when you were about 10, and I have not read the book, so I just want to make sure I've understood what you said correctly. It's set in Svalbard, or part of it is set in Svalbard?
About a third of it, yeah, happens in Svalbard.
And then what was the drink you referred to?
Tokaj. It's a Hungarian sort of sweet wine.
And do you drink that now?
That's my sort of treat drink. Like whenever I'm, when we're on the expedition in Greenland, the one drink I brought with me, my teammate Matt bought sort of quantities of whiskey, and I bought several hip flasks of Tokaj, and that was the sort of celebration drink. Now, whenever we climbed like an unclimbed peak or had like a particularly big milestone in the expedition, we crack out the Tokaj and toast with that.
And I wonder how many explorers have ever cracked out Tokaj on the top of the peak. You might be the only one.
I think whiskey's a more traditional one.
I think so as well. And then the character or characters in The Golden Compass also lived on a barge?
So there's, again, like a large part of the beginning of it is set with these people called the Egyptians, who are a like community of travelers who live on canal boats. And I only moved onto the barge relatively recently, early, like late last year. And that only really occurred to me after I'd started living on the barge. I was like, oh yeah, this is in the book as well. And that plays quite a big, like the main character ends up stowing away in one of them and lives on it for sort of a good few months. And it's funny the impact it's had.
Yeah, it's and it sort of makes sense when you talk about your audio memory, how good your memory is for things you've heard, that it was stored away in your brain, but that it's manifested in these different ways is really fascinating.
It is really fascinating. It's really, I find it really bizarre and kind of a bit uncanny. It makes me think, to what extent am I really in charge of the decisions that I've made? And to what extent are they just sort of the influence, like a few powerful influences on me when I was younger, just coming out over and over again? But I think like I'm kind of an extreme example of that. Like I'm a terrible, terrible multitasker. I tend to have a very one track mind. And I'm not surprised that, you know, sort of I keep manifesting one thing over and over again, because it sort of, it just took up so much of my head.
Well, and I think it, as you said, it does really speak to the power of reading in general, and especially the, I think the importance and the relevance of having children exposed to books and the impact. For example, you and I were talking before the podcast started about Jane Goodall, and Jane talks about, in the introduction to my book, she talks, and in her submission, she talks about the importance of Dr. Doolittle and Tarzan in her life, and deciding at age of 8 or 9 that she was going to Africa to be with the animals. And
wow.
And you know, here she is 85 years old, and look what she's still doing. So
that's amazing, isn't it? Her entire life devoted towards that. And from those kind of like small literary influences when she was young.
Yes, and for me also, my mother reading. I can see the book right now, Encyclopedia of World Travel. And when my youngest memory is of my mother telling me about the pyramids in Egypt and looking at this book and deciding that we would go to Egypt and climb the pyramids. And my mother died when I was a child, but I did. When I was 27, I went to Egypt and climbed the pyramid. And I think it's very important for people to realize the impact that books have on people's lives, and particularly the exposure that when children have them.
It's fascinating how it comes out, isn't it? Because it makes you think, like, what else could have had that impact on your life, apart from people potentially? But I can't think of anything else which might have sort of, impacted you in that way and sort of persuaded you to go off and do that, like climb the pyramids or get Jane Goodall off to study gyms and stuff. It's sort of, it seems unparalleled to me as a kind of form of, as like an influence apart from potentially the people in your life.
Yes. Well, I completely agree. And obviously, why I've devoted so much of my life to this cause, but I'm really fascinated to hear, and I'll have to add the Golden Compass to my very long list of books that I have to read. I'm with The Wolf now. It's on my nightstand. Well, I'm holding it in my hand right now, but I'm reading it right now. Fascinating read. So I'll look forward to The Spider as well, and then the Cuckoo. Whatever American equivalent,
Leo. Yeah, please do add the Golden Compass. It is, it's so special,
Leo. I know with medical school and writing, you really don't have a lot of downtime. Do you have time to read, or what role do reading and books play in your life now?
Yeah, well, reading has played a much bigger part of my life recently, actually. And one of the reasons I moved on to the boat is because I really wanted to make time for it. And I really, really wanted some space without the internet, because the internet's great in its sort of place, you know, when you're using it for work and for research and things like that. But I find that unlimited access to it is really distracting. And you always feel as though there's something really interesting just like a click away. And there never is. And that exposes you to loads of sort of bad news. And I find being, you know, constantly bombarded with notifications keeps you a little bit on edge in like a slightly unpleasant way. And also mostly having access to like the internet and email and things makes it feel as though you should always be on duty. And I find that especially as a, I guess that's the case with kind of pretty much all jobs now. But I find that a lot with writing in my medical studies, that I feel like if I had the internet, I could always be working. And that makes me feel as though I should. So I've very deliberately moved onto this barge, which doesn't have the internet, and made a bit of space for, you know, a few hours every evening where I can just read by candlelight. So I don't have Netflix or TV or anything. And my downtime is entirely books. And I find that slow burn format much more satisfying than, you know, sort of spending time on social media or news websites or whatever it is you waste time doing on the internet. So I've really gone out of my way lately to try and make that a bigger part of my life, because I missed it a lot. Like, I felt like it was increasingly disappearing with just, you know, getting so wrapped up in studies and writing and busyness. And I just wanted more space and time. And I feel like a narrowboat is great for giving you that, for deliberately slowing stuff down.
How much time do you have? I'm trying to understand how you could segment your day between medical school writing and still have time to read. Do you write every day, or do you write in long spurts such as when you go off to the New Hebrides or Outer Hebrides or places like that?
I write every day, but not necessarily on the the trilogy. So at the moment, I have been really delayed. So I've only just finished my account of the Greenland expedition last year, which I feel pretty bad about, because we owed lots of sponsors, you know, sort of nice stuff. So that's not necessarily the best. But so I've just finished that and sort of worked polishing it up so I can publish it lately. So I usually spend about half the day on medical studies and then half the day on writing, and then some exercise in the evening to try and calm myself down a bit, because I find being cooped up inside like that very it really sort of gets me jumping around and wanting to go on a big run, and then usually get back at sort of 9 in time for supper and a few hours reading before bed.
Sounds very disciplined.
Yeah, I'd say I would say my greatest strength is being able to do the same thing over and over again and not get bored of it. So I can eat the same thing and I can do the same thing every day. And I really like that. I love a good routine and I love knowing what I'm going to do, because I find making plans sort of slightly distracting. Mm. Distracting to the point of distressing.
Mm. Well, it sounds like you've really constructed your life in a way that's maximized your opportunity to do that, given that you're on a barge. And if I remember from our conversation, you have to move the barge every 2 weeks. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So it's not easy for other people to find you.
No, it's true. But it's nice for those people who you do want to find you, because I find I see a lot of my friends, because everyone's always keen to come around for a drink and dinner on the barge, or like come and help you move it every couple of weeks. And it's lovely. Like, that's what I mean by slowing it down. Like once every 2 weeks, you have to take a day off, basically. Like I tend to, because I genuinely love everything I do, like medical school and writing and things. I tend to sort of work through the weekends and stuff. And what's really nice about having the boat is it slows you down and it forces you to take a day off at least once every 2 weeks, where you can just chat with your friends and sort of go for a nice cruise on the canals. And it feels like a really sort of positive, a good way of balancing my life, I think.
Well, good. Leo, next time I come to London, I'll come find you.
Absolutely. Come for a cruise.
I'll come for a cruise. What are you currently reading that you might recommend to our listeners?
I've usually got two books on the go, like an audiobook, which I have for commuting and when I'm going to sleep. And at the moment I'm re-listening to Gates of Fire by Stephen Pressfield. And that's a really great book about, it's like a novel about the battle of Thermopylae, you know, the sort of 300 Greeks against the Persians and, you know, like the film, yeah. 300 released, yeah, a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it's the, it's like a much more accurate, much better research
really like beautifully realized telling of that story. And it's really wonderful. Like it's, you get this incredible insight into the mindset of the Greeks who were there, or at least as you can kind of really imagine they would have been. That's a fantastic book. I really recommend it. And then reading wise, I'm on Consolations of the Forest, which is about a book about a man who strands himself in the taiga, the forest in Russia for the winter. And it's really beautifully written. It's this sort of his like reflections on being in this cabin on his own, and it's unexpectedly kind of humorous and wry, and it's very dense in a really good way. Like there's just one like beautiful phrase after another, which really gets you thinking, not a word wasted. So again, I'd really recommend that.
That's Constellations of the Forest?
Consolations of the Forest.
Consolations of the Forest. And who's the author?
Let me remember. Consolations of the Forest.
Well, I'm sure there aren't that many books, Consolations of the Forest, that we can look it up.
Sylvain Tesson.
Sylvain Tesson.
Yes.
Okay, great. And is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
What time is it? What time is it on the barge in on the Thames in London now?
It is 7:50, but actually I'm staying at my brother's to make use of the internet.
That makes sense. Of course. <Yeah.
laughs> Otherwise, it would be slightly difficult to conduct this conversation.
Well, I appreciate
one of the downsides of barge life.
I appreciate your doing that, and I hope you get some time to read tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Thank you, Leo. Bye-bye.
Bye, James.
You've been listening to a podcast production of AW360, the year-round content destination from Advertising Week. Visit AW360 at 360.advertisingweek.com and be sure to check out the other AW360 podcasts now available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Producers on this podcast are Jack Hirschman and Richard Larson, with music provided by Audio Network. For more information on Advertising Week, the world's largest gathering of advertising, marketing, and technology leaders, now in 6 markets across the globe, visit www.advertisingweek.com.